Blasphemous and Blasphemous 2 are Metroidvania action-adventure games developed by the Spanish studio The Game Kitchen. The games have a stunning, distinctive pixel art style and atmospheric world which is inspired by Spanish folklore and religious themes. They are known for their challenging combat and intricate level design. David Arosa is the lead producer and Danny Marquez is a senior programmer on Blasphemous 2. David and Danny join the show today to talk about designing the game systems, the game's development framework, engineering character movement, console optimizations, and more. Joe Nash is a developer, educator, and award-winning community builder who has worked at companies including GitHub, Twilio, Unity, and PayPal. Joe got a start in software development by creating mods and running servers for Gary's Mod, and game development remains his favorite way to experience and explore new technologies and concepts.
Welcome to Software Engineering Daily. I'm your host for today's episode, Joe Nash, and today I'm joined by David Arosa and Daniel Marquez of The Game Kitchen, creators of Blasphemous and its recent sequel, Blasphemous 2. David and Daniel, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, thank you. I'm David. I'm the producer for Blasphemous 2. With us is Danny?
Yeah, I'm Daniel. Danny, I'm one of the programmers of the game.
Awesome. Thank you for putting out your job titles as well. Very helpful and very excited to talk to you today about Blasphemous 2, which I've been playing quite a lot of in the lead up to this. So I guess to kick us off, you know, you mentioned your roles there. We've got a producer and a programmer. Can you talk a little bit about what it is you do at the Game Kitchen and also on Blasphemous?
Well, I always joke by describing my job as I try to prevent people from, you know, tearing each other apart. The producer role is trying to get in sync every of the different aspects that are involved in game development. So you have to know a little bit about programming, a little bit about art, animation, audio, to be very knowledgeable of how all these different areas are related during the development of a game and the dependencies that are involved, and to get to agreements with our publisher in order to keep everyone happy about the progress of the game. So let's say that it's my fault. I'm guilty for everything that isn't really working. That's my responsibility.
It's a very relevant theme with Blasphemous. You are the penitent one for the whole studio.
Well, I wasn't the producer for Blasphemous 1. That was Mauricio, who is the current CEO and director of the studio. I took that role for Blasphemous 2.
Awesome. And Danny, your role as a programmer?
Yeah, well, as a programmer is a wide variety of stuff, but mainly in this game, I was responsible for system and, let's say, architecture. Yeah, in a way. Also rendering stuff too, but mainly systems and architecture.
Awesome. Perfect. We'll definitely want to dig into that shortly. But for folks who haven't played either of the games, can you introduce Blasphemous 2 to us? And I guess the wider world of Blasphemous as well would be useful.
Well, Blasphemous is the second game is a Metroidvania game. The first one was more an action platformer. Some people call it a Souls-like game. That wasn't really the original intention, but, you know, people gave it that description. But Blasphemous 2 is a pure Metroidvania game that is based on a lot of the Spanish culture. It's a dark fantasy inspired by Spanish painting, architecture, or religion inspired. We try to avoid direct references to any kind of religion, but the inspiration is in there.
Awesome. Yeah, I have to confess, I didn't know about a lot of the associated iconography before I played the game. And when, you know, while I was like looking at other interviews about the game and lead by, I saw you comment on Spanish Holy Week in another one. And I looked at the like images from Spanish Holy Week and I was just like, oh, okay, I get it now. I understand. I understand the aesthetic vibe. I'd highly, for any listeners who haven't seen it, definitely look it up. It's definitely an aesthetic. So I guess onto the implementation of the game. What is Blasphemous 2 built in? What are we talking in terms of engine and technologies?
Well, it's built upon Unity Engine. We are using some plugins here and there, but almost everything is written by us from scratch in Unity. Yeah, that's, we code from zero. Okay, we didn't reuse anything from the first part. I have to say I wasn't on the first Blasphemous, so we built this from the ground up upon Unity.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the areas I was really interested in, that as you approach a sequel, you know, especially when there's a lot of shared aesthetic, it's still, you know, they're 2D side-scrolling platformers, etc., how you think about code reuse, how you think about, hey, are we building on the previous game? Is it starting scratch? What was that process like with going from Blasphemous 1 to 2?
What I have to say, like, just because I wasn't there on the first one, I can answer really with much, you know, I don't know the truth or the correct answer, but this one from, we are making sure this one is reusable. Okay. So we didn't make the same mistake again.
I know the reason, because I was there during the development of the three DLCs. When we made the decision to start the sequel, one of the discussions was, of course, what do we do? Do we reuse the old framework that we built for the first game, or should we start from scratch? And this is a really tricky decision, because of course on one hand you have the whole game already built. Most people will think that this is just a matter of, or let's say, switching assets, but the harsh truth is that we wanted to explore many design paths that would be maybe not impossible, but really difficult to implement using the old framework. For example, we only had one weapon in Blasphemous 1, and we have three of those in the sequel. And that's something that I find, I can't even start imagining how would that be implemented. Also, there were many really important things for the gameplay feeling, mainly the controller of the character, that were not great in Blasphemous 1. When the game was released, we are aware that it could be really improved and the controller was improved for the DLCs, but we knew we could do that better. But the only way to do it was to start from scratch. This is something that we are asked about quite frequently. Why did you start a new project from scratch instead of reusing Blasphemous code? It's something that we can't really recommend to everyone. It's a risky decision, and we can't guarantee that everyone would success in making this. So it's not something that we would recommend. We took the risk and it turned out okay, but it could not have been this way.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think a lot of folks would be surprised to hear that, like, adding extra weapons is such a huge constraint. But I guess if you've got a design of a game that's, you know, not assuming there's any reason to switch weapons from the start, it's really, really baked in.
As a listener of Software Engineering Daily, you understand the impact of generative AI. On the podcast, we've covered many exciting aspects of Gen AI technologies, as well as the new vulnerabilities and risks they bring. HackerOne's AI Red Teaming addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses launching new AI deployments. Their approach involves stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. Within the HackerOne community, over 750 active hackers specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and safety testing. In a single recent engagement, a team of 18 HackerOne hackers quickly identified 26 valid findings within the initial 24 hours and accumulated over 100 valid findings in the two-week engagement. HackerOne offers strategic flexibility, rapid deployment, and a hybrid talent strategy. Learn more at hackerone.com/AI. That's HackerOne.com/AI.
I want to follow up on something that Danny said, and, you know, to your last point there, that you wouldn't recommend starting code from scratch. And Danny, you mentioned that, you know, Blasphemous 2 has been built to be reusable into the future. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that that's happened?
Okay. Let's say we build features around, how can I say, let's use the term that Unity make it trendy, like the data-oriented dots technology, something like that, which you said in our framework, it's, okay, don't take me like I'm an expert, but it's like an array of stuff, okay? And we built our engine around modules, okay, let's say the managers of systems that just manage stuff, okay? And you, let's say you just have to add or remove modules in order to implement a feature. This way, for example, let's say some basic example. Let's say you want platforms that when the player stand on it, on them, they dissolve, they collapse. We build this module, okay, that's this the component of that when the player stands still, that will disappear. Okay, so we want to remove it. Just we on the our, let's say, config table, we remove that module and nothing is executed. So that's our first stepping stone, let's say like this way. With that in mind, build all the features. Okay, so we can build features that in the end, they are easy to remove. Okay, maybe we made a little harder to implement, but then it's just a toggle. Okay, I don't want this feature anymore, so remove it from the core of the game. So that's one of the bases on how it's built the framework.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, we could say that Blasphemous 1 was like monolithic kernel.
Sure.
Blasphemous 2 is more modular.
Okay.
Yeah, and more like, I know that the term that data-oriented, like, okay, you got a system, you got components, and the system, okay, will be internally implemented how hard you want, but it's like an array of components.
Sure.
And then you have the game is nothing more of our logic engine, of our logic game is nothing more than a for loop with a deterministic order of modules that, okay, that platforms that disappear, okay, player movement, inputs, reading inputs, etc., etc.
Awesome.
Let's face it, no one likes writing or maintaining documentation. But when you start a technical project or pick up a new task, missing information can cost you valuable time. Gitbook is a technical knowledge platform that fills that information gap, making it easy for your team to capture, maintain, and find information from a single source of truth. Here's a couple of examples. With GitSync, you can set up a two-way sync between your repo and Gitbook, so you can turn Markdown files into awesome, user-friendly docs. And if you make a change in your codebase or a technical writer updates the docs in Gitbook, the edits sync between the two automatically. Or what about when you need to find something in your knowledge base? Forget about searching, just ask Gitbook AI. You'll get a neat summarized answer sourced directly from your docs. Those are just a few examples of what Gitbook can do, but it has plenty more tricks up its sleeve. So why not give it a try? Head to gitbook.com to find out more.
So it's been a little while. I don't think I've touched Unity properly since like 2016. But it sounds to me, this Unity dots thing sounds to me like an entity component system. Is that correct? This is the evolution
exactly.
Of ECS? Awesome. Perfect. I understand. Awesome. That's great. So with that in mind, I guess like when you're thinking about, you know, we want this game to be reusable, and this might be a question that I'm not allowed to ask, but like, is that just for future DLCs, or are you talking like other games entirely outside the Blasphemous universe? Is that, or is it like, you know, we just want to make sure if we do another Blasphemous, we're not writing from scratch without committing to doing another Blasphemous?
That would be the ideal situation.
Cool. I understand.
But theoretically, in other games too. In fact, some modules are being reused in our prototypes.
Awesome. Very cool. So during that, David, you mentioned the movement, which was one of the things that, like, when you look at, you know, Blasphemous players talking about Blasphemous 2, so many people are talking about the control and the movement being like super improved. You said that was, you know, a bit of a complicated process. Can you talk a little bit about what the problems were with like the control in Blasphemous 1 and how you overcome those for 2?
I'm here about to the same situation that Danny. I wasn't during the development of Blasphemous 1. I was one of the backers of the Kickstarter, and I already knew them.
That is awesome. That is a journey.
Yeah, no, we were friends. We knew each other. I already knew Danny as well on that time. But I've heard about that, and I had to deal with the code during the DLCs.
Sure.
So the reason is that Blasphemous was the first platformer game that was made in the Game Kitchen. The previous game, The Last Door, is a point-and-click adventure game, which has nothing to do with this kind of games. So this code was written by Paco, who I hope doesn't listen to this. But he's the one that tells this story. So it was made, you know, like they could. It's not something that they had experience with. It was the first game that Paco made. So that was the best effort that could be put into the game with the resources that they had, which were not many, you know, time, money. Even having a Kickstarter that was successful is not as much money as people think. Money flies when you talk about game development. And it's something that we really wanted to improve in the sense that, hey, now we know what we want to do with the controller. And I think that we could, Danny, correct me with this, but I think that we got even a little bit obsessed with the controller of the character.
Yeah, I can do it a little trip if hope. I'll try my best again with the language, but the character controller, okay, let's say something obvious. Its basic implementation is the character and the controller, obviously. The character is like the physical appearance, okay, like the locomotion and the animations part. That's the character. Then you got the controller, that it's the inputs and the logic you do with that inputs and with the queries from the locomotion and from the character. So we wanted to improve this a little.
Hello.
As I said, let's look at even going a little deeper and say, okay, character controller, just not the character, another, just this another modules. Let's say locomotion, say animation, inputs, say the logic you do with that thing. And then that logic, we divide it with something we call abilities. And these abilities are nothing more than states that can be executed concurrently or exclusively. So we got what I call, that I think I didn't invent it, like hierarchy, finite, concurrent state machine. Okay. The controller itself, what it does is manage these abilities. Okay. Like, for example, jump. When you jump, you cannot crouch. So when the ability of jumping is executed, it blocks the ability to jump. But for example, you can attack. So that can be executed concurrently along with the jump. This way, you got kind of flexibility and you can scale and manage the complexity of the controls because it, okay, then inside each ability or each state, you can implement it as a state machine too. Okay, so that's why it's hierarchical. But inside that ability, you can do more or less like whatever you want in order to do the behavior or make the player, the character do what you want. So we got like the inputs, the locomotion, the animation part, and the abilities. And just our controller just manage then, okay, you can execute or you cannot execute right now, but you can interrupt this one with this ability and things like that. So with that approach, I think we made something that works pretty well.
Yeah.
Much better. In Blasphemous 1, for example, I remember the ladder climbing ability. For trying to find a book on the ladder climbing, you had to check on 3 or 4 different places, including the animator state machine, which was a nightmare. because I think that, well, Paco did, but it was almost impossible for anyone that wasn't Paco to try to deal with the controller issues. Now, with the architecture that Danny and the rest of the team made, it's way more easy to... Yeah. I was going to say to fix issues, but there are no issues.
WorkOS is a modern identity platform built for B2B SaaS. It provides seamless APIs for authentication, user identity, and complex enterprise features like SSO and SCIM provisioning. It's a drop-in replacement for Auth0 and supports up to 1 million monthly active users for free. It's perfect for B2B SaaS companies frustrated with high costs, opaque pricing, and lack of enterprise capabilities supported by legacy Auth vendors. The APIs are flexible and easy to use, designed to provide an effortless experience from your first user all the way to your largest enterprise customer. Today, hundreds of high-growth scale-ups are already powered by WorkOS, including ones you probably know, like Vercel, Webflow, and Loom. Check out workos.com/SED to learn more.
Whenever I think about this topic, the thing that always comes to mind is like the stories you hear of platformers like Super Meat Boy or Celeste, where they say they have like an 1,000 line file of if statements just for the movement and the platforming, right? And so that sounds like a very, as you say, flexible architecture. So you mentioned interrupts there, which I think in action RPGs and anything with, you know, like precisely timed boss combat is always something that players are very conscious on. Like, can I interrupt this ability with a block, for example? It sounds like this architecture allows you to, like, you know, change that and swap it easily, right?
Okay, for example, okay, that's just for curiosity. I was a really Street Fighter 3 fan, okay? And the attack ability, okay, that itself is a change, okay? I really wanted to try to simulate as good as we can that game, because it's really cool how the interruptions of each attack are done. And at least me, I wanted that kind of flexibility that, okay, you can interrupt this ability. For example, the dash, you can, from this frame to this frame, you can interrupt that with the jump, or you can interrupt this with this attack. So you can do, I don't know, the that I try to do, you know, the...
Like the lunge.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the word, lunge. And things like that. We made that, okay, we built a bunch of tools around the frames, like the hit frames or the cancellation frames. That was part of the of our main objective.
That's awesome. Yeah, I started with the big mace, Veredicto, and then the first weapon I unlocked was the pair of rapiers. And it really suddenly felt like I went from like, oh, you know, I'm just going around smashing stuff and that's relatively simple, to like, oh, suddenly I need to be caring about interrupts and, you know, doing fancy tricks with when I pull off different attacks and dashes and lunges. It was a really like striking gameplay transition, which actually, I guess, do you want to introduce the three weapons and how they influence the gameplay, whichever one works?
Yeah, something that we knew for sure, we had a lot of, you know, doubts about what we wanted to do with the sequel, but something that we knew for sure was about having multiple weapons. We weren't sure how many of those, but it's something that we definitely wanted to explore. And also the community have asked about that a few times. Hey, it would be cool if we could use different weapons. And it was really hard trying to do something that could compare to the weapon of the first game, because that sword, Mea Culpa, was kind of iconic to the game. So we had to try to find something that matches that sense of wonder of the first weapon. And that's where code names for the weapons and the elements of the game are stuck in our head. And yeah, I have to think a lot about the real, you know, the public names of the weapons. Is that the sword?
Sarmiento y Centella.
The single sword?
Sarmiento y Centella, those are the pair of rapiers. Rosary Blade is the internal name for the...
Rosalind Blade?
Rosary Blade.
Oh, Rosary Blade. Got it. Rosary Blade. Yeah. Awesome. That makes sense.
We have a lot. Game development is full of silly names.
Cool code names. Yeah.
And silly sometimes. And so that weapon is kind of a cousin of the mea culpa, because they really share the moveset. So there we had the, let's say, mea culpa. But then we wanted to have more variety of gameplay. So that means we need something really powerful but slow. So you have to really commit when you decide to attack with it. That's the sensor.
Yeah, very addictive, which I'm pretty good at.
Ruego l'alba.
Ruego l'alba? Cool.
That's the Rosary Blade. Ruego l'alba.
Okay, Ruego l'alba.
I thought it was all.
Okay.
You mix those.
Okay, so the one big sword, the Rosary Blade, as you call it, is Ruego l'alba. That's the replacement for mea culpa. Okay, I understand. Yes. Yeah.
It's really embarrassing when you come to these interviews and you don't know the real name of the stuff in your game.
Honestly, it's delightful. As a big fan of name-driven development, I'm really enjoying hearing the internal code names and picturing how they came about.
But sometimes people ask us about something and we are like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I forgot the name again. The sensor is really heavy and it punches with a lot of power and it's really powerful and it has this spinning attacks that feel really nicely, but it's kind of slow, so you have to be careful when you use it, because once you commit to attacking with it, we say that you are sold to the enemy. You are at his mercy. On the other side, we have the pair of rapiers, which are Sarmiento y Centella, which is blazing fast, but deals a little bit less damage. And that's, the three approaches that we wanted to try with the three weapons. We find that three is a proper amount of weapons to have in this kind of game. We could talk during hours about the weapon switching feature.
Yeah, that was the first moment when I realized how quick it was to change weapon and how you were expected to change in midair to continue moving, for example. That was the moment where I was like, oh, the skill ceiling on this game is so much higher than I had appreciated so far. Like, it suddenly feels very, you have to understand a lot.
The mechanic for changing the weapon, I think, correct me, Danny, was it 4 or 5 iterations of the weapon exchange?
Don't remember, but I have to say that the difficult part wasn't the technical. It's the feeling.
Yeah.
Was more like, that doesn't feel great. Let's try another thing. And then another thing. And let's try stopping the game for,
half a second. Or let's slow down time. Let's pop up this wheel selection.
I guess just to give an example for listeners who haven't played, so a case where this might come in, for example, the pair of rapiers, you can use those to ride these currents of light, and then at the end of that, there might be a bell you have to smash with the sensor. So you have to, while you're midair, change from the rapiers to the mace really quickly after having done this jump. So I can see why you'd be experimenting with, delays or wheels, etc. That's really interesting.
Yeah, but that introduced, for example, slowing down time introduced the problem of, hey, people can use this to beat bosses way easier than we intended, because they can slow down time and have time to dodge projectiles or to think about what to do. So this was maybe one of the most challenging aspects of the game. One of the most, not...
Oh, well, we'll come back to what the most was. But I guess while we're on the weapons, one thing that I think is really interesting, you described the game as a Metroidvania. So, this idea of gaining equipment and abilities to unlock new areas. But you do that through the weapons as well. They're not just hey, I've got a weapon in my inventory, I have a new style of attack. They're also your navigation ability, your obstacle clearing ability. And then you can choose any of them to start with. So that just seems like a whole heap of design problems, the layout of the world, which areas can people do first, what order do they get the weapons in? How did that decision to give the players that much flexibility come about, and how on earth did you start dealing with that?
That's one of those situations in which maybe you make the decision before knowing the consequences. Truth is that we knew what we were assuming when we decided to give players that selection of weapons. It was quite a challenge for the whole team and design, because they had to take into account that players could go 3 or 4 different paths when they started playing the game. So you have to be able to traverse the world with any of the weapons, and you had to be able to beat the 3 first bosses with any of the weapons. It was an interesting challenge, but I think that it was worth it.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. Yeah, it's one of those things where as you're playing a game and you realize kind of what is happening and how things would play out if you restarted the game. It was one of those elements where I was like, oh, this is very interesting. So you mentioned that the weapons weren't the hardest technical challenge you faced, which I have to ask, what was the hardest challenge?
Don't get me wrong, but we are doing a little indie game. We are not doing AAA game. So just take it with a grain of salt.
Of course.
Maybe one of the things I found difficult was we weren't in charge of the port. Okay, but Switch has some memory limitations. Okay, our artists tend to use really large textures. So that was a little challenge. And also, remember that physics weren't as smooth as we wanted, but that was not in Switch, that a little, but it was just with simple optimizations and level of detail with physics, that was more than okay. But in PlayStation 4,
that was really interesting.
Truth be told, I didn't know how much optimization to do. Luckily, one of the guys from the porting team got an answer from Unity, which I don't know how it works, because it was like, use that instead. Move the 5-6 thread on a different thread.
Because they were facing with the issue of having zones of the game which were running at 60 FPS on the Switch that dropped to 40 on the PS4.
Wow, that's not the order round I would have expected, yeah.
That was our reaction. We were, you know, the Xbox One and PS4 version were released a couple of months after the release of the game, and we were pretty confident about the performance of the game on those platforms. But when the producer of the console port told me, hey, we are hitting a severe frame drop on many songs of the game on PS4, I thought that he was joking, you know? This is a console programmer joke that he's making fun of me. But no, he showed me the benchmarks of the different zones. It was true. There was a huge drop in performance on PS4.
And when you don't know the reason, it's something that when I read it, I was like, I have no idea. I don't know how much or how, I don't know what to do in order to help them.
It turned out to be, as you said, something from the internals of Unity, how it manages different threads or something like that.
I can't do any less raycast, or we can't do any less use of the physics. Yes, we implemented it was very basic, but it was a level of detail. Okay, when the enemies are not on screen, like they are likely puppets, they use a little. For example, instead of 5 or 3 raycast, just 1. And then it's just the bare minimum. We can do anything more. Because if we do less, it's like the leaf NPC or the enemy just ill, and the player will notice it.
The world freezes when you're not on that screen, right? Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah, console porting has been widely discussed on social media and stuff recently because of Godot and, you know, Godot not coming with like facilities for compiling to console like Unity does. And it just seems so many obscure complexities that you need to ask the console developers or porting houses for help with, right? That, yeah, that seems like an impenetrable issue. Fascinating. So earlier you mentioned the bosses, and I wanted to ask a little bit about that, because, you know, in this type of game, you know, with the combat system and I guess like the, as you said, players had kind of given it a Souls-like label on the first one. Obviously, players are very sensitive to boss design, and building a satisfying boss is a whole thing. Like, how did you approach the boss design for this game? Did you have a particular ethos on what you wanted them to feel like?
This is kind of hard to answer, first, because it's not our direct area. But I can say that basically the whole team is always involved in nearly every aspect of the game. Art, enemies, how the game feels. Bosses is one of those places in which everyone has something to say, mainly from the creative direction of the game. Where we try for the bosses to be related to the song they are appearing, trying to be meaningful for the whole story, the game, for the lore. So we try to approach those in a way that they add to the game. They are not in there just for the sake of being a boss in the middle of a palace or in the middle of basement. They have a reason to be there, and they contribute to the lore of the whole game. So the design has to be something that is split between creative direction and game design, and they work together into defining what's going to be the aspect of this boss, what role does it play on the story that we are telling. From that point, they keep on working together to define how it should be. Should this be a humanoid, a human-sized boss? Should it be huge? Does it fly? Does it have multiple? I think we don't have flying. Well, yes, we have one flying boss, which is, I don't know the real name, but it's Susona. Maybe it's Susona, the real name.
I think another one was the, I was going to say the girl in the elevators. I don't remember the name.
It's not a girl, but a ghost.
Ghost girl, okay.
Yeah, ghost. I guess it also depends on your definition of flying. The embroiderer, does a flying thing at points, right?
Yeah, that's a really popular boss. And I like her a lot. We have our favorites as well in the studio.
That's an entire feature we had that I remembered with the bosses and enemies. For example, in the game, you can change, because when you build a boss, maybe you try some behaviors in order to see if the animations are playing correctly or something like that. The game has a hidden feature that you can change, swap the controls to that character and, you know, play a little, test it a little. Also, it wasn't really used much, but it was there. And I used maybe twice, but it was there. And
awesome.
Just to say,
it's
another feature we had in order to test the bosses.
That is great to hear. There are so many, you know, you spoke about the iterations for things like the movement and the controls and the weapons and things like, you know, bosses and platforming segments are another area where I imagine there must be so much testing and iteration for feel. As like, as you mentioned, as like an indie studio, as a smaller studio, what does that testing look like? Like, I think people tend to imagine focus groups and, you know, huge open betas and that kind of thing. But what does it look like for a studio of your size?
Well, it's not until the game is mostly done that we don't start testing in the studio. I think that the first playtesting session was a year before the release. I think it was August 22. That was the first time we had someone from outside of the studio to come and play the game. And that was a point in which you are supposed not to be changing many things, because we had the content complete and the gold version. The content complete was in April, maybe 23.
And what was the total development time?
It was 37 months.
Very producer answer.
Yeah. I remember that people tend to say 3 years, but it started in July. So no, it was 37. So it was in August and the content complete was set for February or April 23, and the gold version for, I think it was May, 1st of May, something like that. So there wasn't really a lot of time to make important changes, but we did change things based on that playtesting session. Well, of course, a playtesting is not the same as a QA session. The publisher starts with the QA of since very early in the development process, but we, you know, that's technical testing. We wanted to see the reaction from players.
Yeah. Making sure the game doesn't break and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. What we wanted to test was the reaction of people who hasn't been playing the game here in front of their faces, well, for 2 years, because it's because you have been playing the game forever. You lose perspective of the game and you fail to see the mistakes or the things that could be improved. So there's this moment in which you need fresh eyes on the game. So we brought people to the studio. I think it was like 12 people, people that we knew. Most of them we knew personally. But when you make this kind of testing sessions, you don't need a fan who will be happy with whatever they play, because they are excited to try the sequel of the game, so everything will look great. Well, we wanted to have people who are really brutally honest with the game. Yeah.
Excellent.
So, yeah, we contacted these people who were, some of them were friends of us, asked them to be brutally honest with the game. And from that session, we got a lot of good feedback that we implemented. One of the feedbacks that we got was related to the weapon change system. Okay. I remember we give them, you know, pen and paper so they can write down their thoughts and their comments. Then they fill a form online with their thoughts. And there was something, one of the players left the paper on the desk, and there was this comment. I'm trying to translate it. Sorry for my French in here, but it said, "Weapon changing, motherfucker."
Excellent.
So when we saw this, we were suspecting that the system wasn't really what people expected, but that phrase, that comment, confirmed it. That was in August, and then we had another playtesting session in February. I think it was February, barely a month before the content complete, which was really risky. You know, it was barely a month before delivering the alpha of the game. So there was not enough time to make huge changes.
Sure.
But being as we are, we made big changes in some systems that we weren't really happy about, like some things that maybe people take for granted, like, when did you save the game?
Right.
What if I have explored this huge amount of the map and then I die? Do I have to go through the whole map again, or is this progress saved and you keep every item that you already found? Because this, which seems pretty obvious, wasn't that obvious during the development. That's one of the things that we changed with that playtesting session. I think that we weren't saving the progress after dying. People got really angry about that during the playtesting session, because you had to remember, I went to this place and I picked this item, and then I had, I don't know, money in this place and this boss is over here. We enter in kind of a crisis state in the team because we needed to fix that, but we weren't sure what to do. At the end, it's like with the weapon change, the solution, the final decision is something that after it's made, it looks pretty obvious, simple, but it wasn't.
One of the versions of the when saving the game was the classic Metroid or Castlevania approach, that is, you save, on a room, okay, or right. the Pleiadia in our case. And when you die, you appear there, like you were never there except the guild. Okay, so it was like, this is a little weird. You go back to, you restore the state, but the guild is there, and that doesn't have much sense. So.
Yeah, because the guild is on a zone of the map that you haven't discovered yet, because we were removing the progress on the map. That was one of the first versions.
Yeah. I get it. Okay. For listeners, so when you die in Blasphemous 2, you gain guilt, and that changes like mechanics and different like what abilities you have and how much mana, etc. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, sorry, for a moment there, I was like, I thought you were saying that the guilt always appears somewhere you haven't been, and I was like, wait, did I just completely miss that on my playthrough? But no, I understand. No, no, no. I mean, so you roll back to that progress. Yeah, okay.
But it was like, okay, the idea now sounds obvious, but a lot of games implement, like we did, like Metroid, and it just works. But
right.
when we tried it, it didn't work for us.
Yeah.
So.
We changed enough of the Metroid formula that you've broken a standard element of it.
That sounds obvious, but it's not so obvious, because if for Metroid works, why it doesn't work for us?
Yeah. And you've ended up with, I guess, a checkpoint system that I guess is the only Souls-like, well, one of the most Souls-like remnants, where you kind of have this, like, you know, you save at a checkpoint and that's where you come back, and then you have to go pick up your guilt in a very kind of, you know, yeah, awesome way. Perfect. Wonderful. We are getting close to time, so I wanted to ask a couple of questions to wrap up. And I guess the first one, do you keep an eye on the speedrunning scene for Blasphemous 2? You mentioned earlier that players, you know, being conscious that players will break things. Do you pay attention to what they're up to?
Honestly, I keep an eye on the community in general, mostly Reddit. Most of the people from the team are not really, don't really interact with the community, but there are people who are constantly interacting with social media, but most of us don't. We see what people comment about the game and what they want us to do with the game. This morning, I sent the lead programmer a thread from Reddit in which someone was talking about the progress of the Rapier and Dagger. And hey, check this and see how much reason this person has. But for the speedrunning thing, I haven't seen anything yet for Blasphemous 2.
Okay.
We did for Blasphemous 1, yeah. And I remember that the first speedrun that we saw as a team, I was cooking on the kitchen, and I had my iPad on the side, and I was checking the speedrun, and I was like, how is he doing that? What was that jump? Because there was a book on the jumping, let's say, system, because Blasphemous 1 didn't even have proper systems that allowed players to jump in an infinite amount of distance. But I haven't seen that for Blasphemous 2. It's not that it doesn't exist, honestly. Yeah. I'm sorry. I don't know. Now I'm curious. When we finish this, I will
go
and
check. There's some fast runs. There was the fastest run. There was a really fast run that got submitted for Games Done Quick that I believe the reason it got rejected was because you patched it. And I don't think you patched it intentionally, but a patch you released fixed the run. So there are some quick runs.
We made only one update to the game. And honestly, I don't remember.
It was a sub 40-minute run, and then the patch fixed it, which was
amazing. I remember it. It was something like pause the game when
the rune switching. When you do the plunge attack with the Rosary Blade,
exactly.
You could use...
Or something like that, or with prayer that freeze the times.
Yeah, I remember that. And I did that myself when I saw it, which sends you upwards.
Yeah,
that's one we patched. Yeah.
Amazing. So I guess inevitable question, and it's totally okay if you can't, but can you share anything about what's next for Blasphemous 2, or, you know, what else the Game Kitchen is working on?
As a company, I can say that the Game Kitchen is working on multiplayer projects. Some of those are public, like the VR platform that is being built. But sadly or luckily, most of the projects are not public yet. As for Blasphemous 2, after the release of the game and the update, we took a really long holidays, most of the team, those who could afford. I'm sorry for Danny, because he's one of the few who couldn't. And I didn't took as many days as I was supposed to have.
Blasphemous 2 started really soon after Blasphemous 1, right? There wasn't much gap between the two of them.
That's something that we didn't talk about, but Blasphemous 2 started the development while we were working on the three DLCs.
Okay. Yeah, so you were long overdue a holiday.
So Blasphemous 2 started in July 2020.
Yeah.
The first DLC was released, I can't remember. I made a presentation not long ago and I had to check all the dates because I totally forgot. I think it was February 21. I think it was more than a year. Mm-hmm. Or maybe September 2020, October. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't remember. I had to check Wikipedia the last time. So yeah, we overlapped the two developments.
Yeah, very overdue holiday. You took a lot of time after Blasphemous 2 and still thinking about it?
When we came back from holidays, then we started talking with Mauricio and with our publisher about the future of the game. We haven't decided anything yet. If we had, I couldn't say. So
of course. Absolutely. Had to try.
Yeah, I know. For sure, there's always things mm-hmm. that teams want to add to a game. I don't know who said this, but games are not finished, but abandoned. So we would like not to abandon it yet, but...
That feels truer than ever in the age of, you know, games being patched online. Long gone are the eras where you shipped a cartridge and didn't have to think about it ever again. Perfect. Well, thank you both so much. This has been delightful. It's always nice to learn more about how the games we play are built. So thank you both for your time today.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us, Joe.